is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi there, this is Eric Horseman from the Beacon Orthopedics Flying to the Hoop Basketball Tournament, and you're listening to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klintzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are jumping on one night after the end of a crazy Celtics Heat series that we have a lot to talk about. And then we're also going to unpack our upcoming NBA Finals, Denver Nuggets versus Miami Heat. So, Jay, do you have a game for me?
I do have a game, Mike. Right, it's a little all different right. Of a take. All right. Here we go.
All right.
Playoff record, Mike. Most losses in the NBA playoffs. What top five players with the most losses in the NBA playoffs?
Just in the playoffs. All right. So this is somebody who has to have won a lot, but also has to have lost a lot. I'm going to go with LeBron.
He's number one.
Kareem.
He is not anywhere on my list.
No. Okay. Somebody else who has lost a lot of finals games, lost a lot of playoff games. Man, it gets tough quick. Jerry West.
I don't see him on my list.
No, because he lost a lot of finals, but made it to a lot of finals. So we're talking about playoff losses. So playoff, I'm guessing This has to be people that are more recent vintage who have played a lot of playoff games.
I would say they've all been playing in my lifetime, but I would not say that they are recent, all recent players.
Okay. Man, this is a tough one.
I know. Well, listen, Mike, here's what I want to say. LeBron has 100 playoff losses, okay? Hazard a guess of how many wins he has.
Is 100 losses?
Yeah.
I would say he has... That's a good one. Not many more than that.
He has 182 wins. He's 182 and 100 in the playoffs, Mike.
Okay. All right.
That's pretty bananas.
That's a lot of playoff games. So I'll say, let's go Tim Duncan.
Oh, there you go. Number four.
Let's go. I need somebody else. So how about Manu Ginobili?
Nope. He's number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. He's 11.
Tony Parker?
He's six.
Man, somebody else who played a long time and made a lot of play. Karl Malone.
Oh, number three.
John Stockton.
Number five.
So I have
the other guy. The other guy's tough, Mike. The other one's tough. He was not what you would call superstar.
Robert Horry?
No, but you're I would think in that vein. Robert Horry is number 8. Or number 7. I would think in that vein though. He also coached for a little bit.
All right, let's see. Man. So I have number 1,
number 3, 4, 5, 6 and all 7. Right.
Okay, so I just don't have number 2.
He also coached.
He coached
for a hot second. Hot second. He's a lefty. Guard.
A lefty guard who coached. Man.
He played for a lot of teams in the playoffs. He played with someone who died recent, like in the last few years.
Don Nelson?
It's Derek Fisher, Mike.
Derek Fisher. Okay. There you go.
Number 2. Derek Fisher. He has the second most NBA wins in the playoffs, Mike.
Long career.
Or the second most. He's 98 losses and 161 wins in the playoffs.
Wow.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Yes. That's a lot. It's a lot. I guess I wouldn't have. Yeah, it would have taken me a long time.
161 and 98.
Would have taken me a long time to get to Derek Fisher.
Yeah. Well, there's that for you.
That was a good one. A little different. That was a little different. I liked it. Took me a minute to get on the right brainwave there.
Well, listen, I just wanted to switch it up a little bit. I didn't want to think it's like, oh, so we kind of, I theoretically could come up with a bunch of other of these ones, but I figured that one was.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That was a good one. So, all right. So I don't even know where to start other than like, man, that meme you sent me last night, Gone Fishing with Bill Simmons and his dad. That was a good one. That was a good one.
That was funny. I did enjoy that.
Did you listen to the podcast?
I did. I thought that honestly that Simmons and his dad were pretty coherent and realistic about what happened. I didn't really sense a case where they were talking about how Boston got shafted or that this or that, or if only these things would have happened. I think that Simmons has come to the realization that this Boston team just is inherently flawed and they are who they are. And I just think you can go down the line one by one with each of these guys, and which I guess we can do too. If you just want to start with Tatum, right? We've talked about Tatum for years and years, and I know he got hurt on the very first play and turned his ankle, but I still feel like, and this is me being biased against Jason Tatum, but I still feel like you turn your ankle and you're a superstar and you still figure out some way to carry your team across the finish line in a game 7 at home.
There's no way LeBron acts that way if he turns his ankle at 38 years old. There's no way he acts like that in the game.
I just don't think you disappear in the way that Tatum disappeared. And look, I know the ankle hurt and it's an injury and I'm asking him to do something and push his body
something that he doesn't do when he's healthy.
Right. Right. Exactly. And so it just feels like in a game 7 at home that if he's really a top tier superstar, which we've argued repeatedly that he's not, that he would have pushed him over the edge and he was nowhere to be found. And then you go to Jaylen Brown and he was just, I mean, he was horrendous. Absolutely horrendous.
He ended up with 11 turnovers, right?
Eight.
Oh, so
it might have felt like 11, but it was 8 was bad enough.
I heard someone say 11 somewhere, and I was like, and his 3-point shooting was horrendous. Like
not only the shooting itself, not only the results of the threes, but the threes that he was taking. Oh, in the third quarter where they were still, I mean, they were still pretty much out of it, but he had at least 2 or 3 possessions where he just dribbled the ball down the floor and pulled up from 4 feet behind the line at the top of the key without passing the ball to anybody. And the number of times that I know we've been talking about this again all year, and something that Simmons harped on too, about he drives into traffic and the ball just gets poked away. And that happened to him 3, 4, 5 times last night, where he's driving to nowhere. I mean, he's driving to traffic and the ball gets knocked away from him.
When Simmons said that, Mike, I thought, like, that's what we talk about with Evan Mobley. But Evan Mobley's not a guard, and he's 7 feet. And sometimes he kind of does, like, his ball handling, his work. But Jaylen Brown is supposed to be someone that can handle the ball and putting himself into position to do that. So that shouldn't happen with someone like Jaylen Brown, right? That was where my immediately thought when I heard Simmons say that. I was like, you know what? That sounds like Evan Mobley, except Evan Mobley's in his second year and he's 7 feet tall and he definitely needs to work on his handles. But that's not something that he's like – he will get better, I think. But Jaylen Brown shouldn't be in the same thought process as Evan Mobley at this point.
Not at this point. Not at age 26 as a guy who's second team All-NBA.
Yeah.
You would think that – but this is what he's done, I think, pretty much for his whole career. I mean, he's had this issue of being able to handle the ball in traffic and just not being solid with the ball. And that's a problem. And I think that the other thing that we've touched on a little bit and that we saw in this game and we saw throughout the series is just the fact that Jason Tatum is an average playmaker for being the best player on a team. He's not a great, great passer. He's not a guy who necessarily makes other players better. Like, I look at Tatum's best skill as being his ability to score rather than his ability to set up other guys. And then you look at Jaylen Brown, and he's someone who historically has a 1-to-1 assist to turnover ratio, which, as a guy who
his career is 2.2 assists per game and 2 turnovers per game. So pretty close.
Yeah. I mean, essentially 1-to-1.
But I want to point this out though, Mike, his first 4 years in the NBA, he didn't turn it over very much. It's been the last 4 years that have been bad. The last 4 years, 2.2, 2.7, 2.7, 2.9.
Well, the ball's been in his hands more, right? As his role has increased. Yeah. He's been asked to do more. Yeah,
giving a little bit of credit. I like that, Mike. Give him
the
benefit of
the problem is that as he handles the ball more, he's had more turnovers, and he really hasn't improved as a playmaker, as a guy who can get the ball to his teammates and make his teammates better. And when you have your best player, and this is where the Tatum and Brown thing, right, there's a lot of positives. You look at it and you say, around the league, two wings like this, this is what everybody's looking for, are guys who are long, versatile, can defend multiple positions, can score. In that way, they seem like they're a perfect pairing. And yet, when you start looking at Boston, you start looking at, well, why do they struggle, right? Why one game are they lights out, and then the next game looks like they've never played basketball before? Or why within this series, can they lose 3 in a row, then win 3 in a row?
It's kind of how I feel when I golf, Mike.
Yeah, there you go, right? It's where you hit one good shot every once in a while and you feel great. You're like, oh, you know, I can really be a good golfer. And then you realize, well, no, I can't be because I'm just not consistent. I think part of that, honestly, and it really came out last night, is that they just don't do a good job of setting up their teammates for easy shots on a consistent basis. They don't draw double teams and then find the right guy. Like, you compare and contrast the way the Celtics offense runs versus the way, let's say, the Nuggets offense runs. And I know Jokic is an all-time playmaker, and you're not asking Tatum or Brown to be an all-time playmaker. But the problem is that when Boston's threes aren't going in like they did in Game 6 and they did in Game 7, they really just end up being then a team that goes one-on-one, and they're not really puncturing the defense. They're not really getting anybody easy shots, other than, again, sometimes the ball moves on the perimeter and they're able to get open threes, and sometimes you knock them in, sometimes you don't. But it feels like Boston's offense has become really, really one-dimensional. I know they asked Joe Mazzulla. I don't know if you saw that clip of him being asked.
Was he clapping?
What do you think about? No. But just they asked him about, what do you think about diversifying the offense? It seems like if your threes go in, then you win. If they don't go in, you lose. And what was plan B? And he's just like, he said something to the effect of, the threes just have to go in, or they didn't go in, or no, our offense is fine. And yeah, man, you just watch that game, and to play that way at home and have your two best guys come up small. I mean, as a Celtics fan, it would have to be tremendously disappointing. As a Celtics hater, it was a pleasure to watch. But as a Celtics fan, you have to look at those two guys and you have to say, do we want to play? And they got a lot of decisions to make this offseason. So, and I don't know how much we want to get into that right now or finish out talking about these games, but I don't want to pay Jaylen Brown $295 million for the next 5 years, personally.
What do you think the Celtics do? Do you think they end up signing him?
I think you end up signing him. I think they do because
you try
I don't
to shop
know.
Him?
Well, I think you could try to shop him, but the question is, do you shop him? Because he has another year left on his contract, right? So that $295 million is a contract extension that he's eligible for. So theoretically, they could offer him something. He could turn it down. Theoretically, they could offer him the max. He could sign it. Theoretically, they could offer him less than the max. He could sign it. They could start shopping him now as a guy who has 1 year left on his contract. They could sign him and then start to shop him after he's already signed a contract. So there's lots of different ways they can go. Honestly, I see him signing an extension with Boston, probably for the max, but I'm not 100% sure that that means that Jaylen Brown is going to be a Celtic next year. I could see them signing him and then after that, at some point, trying to work a trade. I just know it with the new collective bargaining agreement and the way that that second apron, so to speak, which is what everybody's been calling it, the going over that is so punitive. And if you have Tatum and you have Brown on what's going to ultimately end up being
two maxes,
they're going to end up paying those guys, yeah, over $100 million for two guys. And I think the second tier kicks in at, I want to say it's like 171 maybe or something.
I thought it was 181, but I was losing my numbers. My head was hurting, and I'm a math teacher. My head was hurting listening to the Russillo Simmons podcast.
Yeah, whatever that number is, there's not a whole lot of money left over for the other 12 players on your roster if you're going to pay two guys at that amount. And look, a lot of teams, if you're going to win a title, you're going to have to pay two guys that amount. The question is Tatum and are Tatum and Brown the two guys that you want to pay that amount to? And you can convince yourself either way. There's compelling arguments to be made on both sides of it, right? You can look at it and say, well, look, last season they're up 2-1 on the Warriors. It takes a unbelievable game four from Stephen Curry that kind of swings the momentum.
Yep.
And you lose that series. You lose the NBA Finals. This year, you're back in the Eastern Conference Finals. You lose Brogdon during the series. Miami's playing completely and what...
By the way, Brogdon looked so bad when he was out there yesterday. He looked like...
I mean, I was surprised they left him out there for as long
Mike,
as...
Mike, it looked like you or I could have been out there shooting those shots.
I mean, that first shot that he took, that thing missed by like 8 feet. And at that point, I was like, why is he still in the game? And I mean, the Celtics, they just... I mean, it all comes back to Tatum and Brown, and you want more from those guys than what they've given you in terms of being the top tier. I can depend on you every single game to be at your best. I've been saying it for years with Tatum that he's not at that level, and maybe he'll still get there. I mean, he's 25 years old, so he still probably has the best years of his prime ahead of him, but the inconsistency worries me. It worries me at the highest level, whether or not I can count on him every game. Like, I know what I'm getting out of the very best players that are historically great. I know what I'm getting. There's a floor with those guys, and I don't feel like there's a floor with Tatum. I mean, he can have 50 in a game seven, and then he can get you 17. Yeah. To me, that's not what I'm looking for.
Yeah, and then the other thing too, Mike, I just want to point this out there, that I didn't really like grasp until like listening to Simmons, like them talking about, you knew the Heat were going to come out in a zone defense. How do you not have a plan of attack? I mean, that's something like myself as a middle school basketball coach, if I play a team once and then I'm going to play them again, and I'm like, oh crap, that team ran a zone. I need to like figure it out, or like I sit and watch film and try to figure it out. And I'm a middle school coach. Like, I'm not saying I'm good at completely planning it, but I at least know what's coming and I have theoretical plans in place. The Celtics looked like they didn't have any plan in place. And I know that all could have been hampered by the Tatum injury. I want to like say that because theoretically that like the first play of the game was against the Heat were right into the zone right away. Right. And yeah. Tatum ran that to that dunker spot and attacked it and turned his ankle. And maybe that was the plan, but they had to go away from the plan because Tatum was hurt. But I don't know if I believe that because it just looked like it was so discombobulated. Like they weren't going to play Tatum 48 minutes. So like they had to have a plan in place and they looked like they didn't have any plan in place. So,
well, it's interesting because, right, I think a lot of times when you think about how do you attack a zone, you have a guy at the high post that you want to get the ball into that guy and then you want that player to make plays. And typically the two types of players that get put in there, one is the type that the Celtics put in there, which is your Al Horford guy, which is one of your big men who's maybe the best passer slash IQ guy. That's the guy you put at the high post. That's one choice. And then the second choice would be you put a guy who's your best playmaker. So in theory, right, with the Celtics, you'd probably want to put Tatum in that spot. Now, there were numerous times in that game where Horford caught the ball at the free throw line, turned, and there was nobody there, either for him to shoot a 16-footer or for him to kick out. And he kicked out several times for threes, and a lot of times guys missed. I know once or twice they knocked him down. But it felt like that middle was really vulnerable. But it was vulnerable not just to getting the ball there and then kicking out, but it was also vulnerable to a guy getting the ball there and then going and attacking. And it just didn't feel like Boston did that. And look, I'm always hesitant to blame coaches for all the things that we see because ultimately players still have to execute and a coach can diagram. How many times have you diagrammed something for your team that you want to have happen and then the players don't execute it? And again, you're coaching a completely different level. I understand.
I'm going to be completely honest with you when I say most of the time.
Correct. So look, even at the NBA level, things get diagrammed, things get shown,
players like LeBron disregard David Blatt's play call and call their own play.
Or the players read something different than what the coach is reading from the sideline or what they anticipated was going to happen. And so when you're talking about the greatest players in the world, they make their own adjustments and they play the game and it is what it is. So I'm hesitant to completely blame, Mazzola for this, but
at the same time, Mazzola?
Yeah, sorry. Crazy Joe Mazzola.
Mozzarella.
Yeah. Mozzarella. Mazzola.
I'm just giving you a hard time, Mike. I'm sorry.
No, it's good, man. It's all good. So anyway, I'm hesitant to just completely throw Joe under the bus, but it does feel like they had to figure out a way that they knew the zone was coming.
By the way,
so you got to take.
By the way, when they were talking Simmons, I know we keep referencing Simmons. When they're talking about Simmons, they're like, "What coach is out there?" Notice they didn't mention Mike Budenholzer's name. How awesome!
No, Coach Bud did not come up at all.
How awesome would it be if Bud ended up as a Celtics coach? I think Simmons' head would explode. It would be the greatest thing ever.
That would be fun. Let's start a campaign
Coach Twitter Bud to Boston. Campaign, Coach Bud like to it. Boston.
Let's do it. I like it.
Milwaukee wins again, and it's like all we needed to do was send Coach Bud to Boston and
sabotage them. He's like a secret agent.
I just think what's interesting about this whole series is just the psychological things that people always talk about, whether you think about, hey, one team's got the momentum or the Heat just were completely devastated after the result in game 6 and there's no way they're going to be able to come back and they got to go on the road, or man, Boston just pulled this game out from nowhere and now they're just going to be able to go home and Miami's going to be crushed and Boston is going to be on this high and they're just going to come in and they're going to take care of business. And pretty much every single thing that you would have expected in terms of conventional wisdom was kind of turned on its ear in this series, from home court advantage meant next to nothing starting with the first two games that Miami wins in Boston, which obviously nobody really saw coming. Then they win game three in that just destruction where everybody basically is saying, hey, Boston rolled over, and it certainly looked that way. And when that happens, you certainly don't expect the Celtics to turn that around and come back and in Miami win that game four. Then you're like, okay, well, Boston got one, so Miami's going to go home, and now they got to take care of business, and they'll win that game six. And it just, there were so many different strange things that went on in this series. And you have to give Miami a ton of credit.
Who's the biggest loser in this series, Mike? Here's my pitch. Derek White, because no one's going to remember that game winner.
Yeah, that shot's going to get lost in history. There's no doubt. I mean, people in Boston will always remember it, but it won't be remembered or revered in the same way it would be if they had moved on to the finals. And certainly if they had won the NBA finals, that shot becomes...
That becomes the bloody sock. That's the bloody sock.
Yeah, it becomes one of the most famous shots in the history of basketball. Whereas now it will be something that will be... It will be remembered by a select few, but it won't be remembered in the same way.
It's the LeBron 2009 shot against the Orlando Magic.
Right. It's a fun highlight.
My dad was at – I wanted to say this, Mike. I went to the PGA last week. My dad was at the LeBron 2009 Orlando shot, and I referenced it, and he didn't remember it. He was at that game, Mike. Now, my dad's old. He's getting old, okay? He's getting old.
That's not good that he didn't remember that.
And I'm like, Dad, you were at the game, because I was in Africa doing a mission trip, and like and the only internet I had was dial-up, Mike. So this is a fun story here. All the internet they had was I had to go to an internet cafe to check the scores. And I literally watched internet was still relatively good, but it's still not good. And it was definitely not good where I was. And all I know is they were like, LeBron hits game winner. I saw it, pulled up the ESPN article, and this is what I saw. I saw LeBron, and I saw the ball go like this. And then I saw him celebrate. I never saw it go in the basket. I never saw any of that. And I remember sending my dad an email saying, oh, you know, and I tried to find the email, but I don't have access to my BW account anymore. It's saying, oh, man, you got to go to that game. You're so lucky, blah, 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 blah. I couldn't find – and his email, like, response was good too, but, like, he didn't remember it. I'm like, how do you not remember this, Dad? Like, come on.
Well, there you go. So there's going to be somebody at the Garden that doesn't remember, or somebody in Miami that's not going to remember that shot from Derek White. Well, I guess the Miami fans are going to try to block it out. So, but it definitely is not going to carry the same weight.
Sorry for that tributary. No, it's all good. I figured I would.
But it's not going to be remembered. That shot's not going to be remembered in any way, shape, or form in the same way. And I think it's funny too that people were criticizing Strus for allowing Derek White to get to the basket. And I mean, if you watch that entire play and then you saw Spoelstra talk about it after the game, where basically what Strus's job was to try to keep Tatum from getting the ball. So when Tatum popped out towards the inbounder, Strus completely jumped in the passing lane and took Tatum away. Then the ball goes into Marcus Smart and he just gets that shot off so fast. And I mean, from the time Strus denied Jason Tatum to when he turned back around after the pass and went to Marcus Smart, I mean, Strus is running to try to get back to Derek White. I mean, you can watch the play and see him like trying to get back. And I mean, look, plays like that, when they happen, they're all one in a million. Like, you can say things had to go perfectly and the ball had to go here and White had to cut there and Strus couldn't be there and somebody else couldn't have stepped in or whatever. But that's what makes these plays what they are, right? I mean, if you look at the win probability, you know, the win probability for the Celtics was, you know, 1% at that point. Yeah. And so, right. So 99 times out of 100, all those things, there's something that goes wrong if you're the Celtics and it just doesn't happen. And so I think when you're looking at that play, you just have to take it as it was a really smart play by Derek White to not just stand in the corner, but to crash. But you can't really fault Miami for, one, in 3 seconds, the odds of a guy getting a shot off, having it be – look, how many times have we seen on threes, right? Where does the ball usually go if a guy misses a three, right? That thing's clanging back out to 15 feet away, foul line extended, somewhere out there where it doesn't matter what happens. Like, nobody's grabbing that rebound and putting it back in. So for that thing to kind of rattle and then softly fall off the rim right into Derek White's hands, I mean, the odds of that happening are infinitesimal. And kudos to White for getting it done. And obviously it was a great win for the Celtics, but they just could not, they could not double down on it at home. And Celtics, again, they're just a goofy team. Goofy team. Their two best guys are goofy because you don't know what you're getting from them. And man, I don't know what. Yeah, if I'm Boston, I don't feel great about signing Jalen Brown, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure what you can get for him. Like, what can you get for Jalen Brown? I know there's a lot of Portland talk that, but does Portland want Jalen Brown for Lillard? Or I also saw the Simons and maybe the third pick for Jalen Brown. Does Jalen Brown and Damian Lillard together, does that make a championship roster?
I mean, Damian Lillard's about, I mean, would you rather Damian Lillard than Jason Tatum? Like, maybe a little bit, but I mean, I think Tatum's ceiling's probably theoretically higher at this point because Lillard's a little older, right? So,
yeah.
And Lillard's never been there. He's never even gotten, I mean, they've gotten to the Western Conference Finals once in his career, I think.
Yes.
So, like, I don't know. I just don't think if you're Portland. I'm still thinking that Cavs, come to the Cavs, bow to the Cavs.
How, though? How?
Listen, I'm just throwing.
It's impossible. There's no possible way that could happen. You're already looking at if you're the Cavs and you're going to keep this core together. I'm just talking it through. You're already looking at Mitchell's on a max, Garland's on a max, Mobley's going to be on a max. Jared Allen, obviously, in that scenario, there's no chance of the Cavs re-signing him. And I think does he still have 2 years left?
Yeah, I think so.
I feel like he has 2 years left. There's just no way you can.
Listen, starting lineup of Jaylen Garland, Brown. Mitchell, Brown, Mobley, Sideshow Bob.
I don't know. I don't want Jalen Brown. I'm not a fan. I'm not either.
I'm just saying.
I don't want to pay Jalen Brown half of what he's going to get.
I know if that opportunity presented itself, it would slightly be intriguing. I'm not saying that it's going to happen, but it would slightly be intriguing, right?
Yeah, I just don't know what scenario. No, it wouldn't be. Not for what Jalen Brown's going to make.
Okay.
Not for what he's going to make.
Okay.
I wouldn't be that excited to pay Jalen Brown $25 million a year, to be honest with you. Not on this team, anyway.
Okay.
Not on this team. He does more than what this team needs, and he doesn't do it
well enough
to make the difference. Like, I don't want a guy in that spot who is capable of. I mean, obviously, look, he scored like 26 a game this year, so clearly, he's. I mean, look, Jalen Brown's a really good player, but I don't want him having the ball more than Mitchell or Garland, and hopefully not Mobley. Look, we've said it a million times, right? I mean, until Mobley's the best player on this team, you're not winning a title with this core. You're just not. Mobley has to be.
Yep.
Mobley has to be their best player.
I didn't mean to make this turn into the Cavs talk. I apologize.
That's all right. We need to talk some Miami. We talked a lot of Boston.
Yeah, but listen, I just want to say Miami, congrats. Like, you deserve it. You played hard. You worked hard. You have the better coach. I mean, Butler was really not that great the last three games of this series.
I thought he looked slow.
Well, they said he's hurt. They said that on the broadcast last night. There were a few times when they're like, he looks like he's hurt. But unlike Jason Tatum, he's not going to like grimace every single time he moves. Like, he's playing through it. I definitely think he wasn't himself the last few games, and he doesn't have a lot of time to recover. So it'll be interesting to see, will he be able to recover? What will they look like? But listen, Miami gets all the congratulations in the world. They're only the second team
as the 8 seed to make the NBA Finals. Who's the only other team, Mike?
The 99 Knicks, baby, in a strike-shortened season.
Yep, Jeff Van Gundy, baby. So now it's going to be a full circle moment. He's going to be broadcasting all the games.
There you go.
For it. So I'm not really like thinking Miami has much of a chance this series, Mike, and I'm not trying to jump the gun here. But I've read an interesting stat today, Mike. How many NBA finals has Pat Riley been a part of?
Ooh, that's a good one. So, man.
As a player, as a coach, and as general manager slash president front office.
All right, well, since he's been in Miami, he was with...
I could give you a percent of the total NBA finals if that would help you.
Nah, let me just try to do it. Let me try to do it straight out. Let me think through it. So since he's been in Miami, right, they made it in 2006. They have made it in, let's see, they made it all 4 years that LeBron, Wade, and Bosh were there. So that's four.
Yeah, Mike.
Then they have made it in this year. So that's six. So we have six with the Heat. He probably has been in with the Lakers, man. Well, you've got a Knicks one in there, maybe. I'm going to go with the number being, let's say, 19.
Oh, you had to look it up while you were gone.
No, I didn't. I swear.
So what did you? So it was. So here's the question.
Well, I could have gone through the whole entire process, which I didn't. But what did I have? I think I had six in Miami, and then I figured there was a. He was obviously the coach with the Lakers for numerous NBA finals.
How many as a player, Mike? How many as a player did he have?
I would say three, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, I mean, that was a lucky guess, but sort of based on at least a little bit of knowledge.
So my next question, Mike.
All right.
How many NBA finals has Udonis Haslem been in?
Well, he's been in all the Miami ones, so I would say six.
Seven. Because there was one before Riley was there, back.
Okay.
Right? 03? Is that right?
Were they?
It says Pat Riley and Udonis Haslem are going back to the NBA Finals. This will be UD's seventh appearance. Oh, maybe wait. Wasn't
he had to be with somebody else. He had to be with somebody else. He couldn't have been with.
No, wasn't Riley a coach for the Heat early and then went to the executive?
But I can't. Did the Heat get to the finals before 2006 with Wade?
Hold on.
Was there a pre Dwayne Wade Miami Heat finals that I'm blanking on?
Wait. I'm gonna see if I can find this out.
I don't feel like there was, but maybe I'm wrong.
Hold on. I don't want the hat. Heat NBA finals appearances. 2006, 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014, 2020. Hold on. Before.
Oh, 2020. That's the one we're forgetting. The bubble.
And then this the bubble.
One. Yeah, we forgot the bubble. I forgot the bubble. So.
But 2006 would have been. 2006 would have been Riley was the coach, right? Riley was still the coach back
Correct.
Then.
Correct. Yeah, I believe that's
and
true.
And the rest have been as an executive.
That's true. Yeah. Okay. There we go. Well, look, you got to give the Heat, as you said, a ton of credit. Jimmy Butler was, although he was good, I wouldn't say that he was peak Jimmy like we saw
Caleb
from him.
Caleb Martin, baby.
Caleb Martin was unbelievable. I mean, absolutely unbelievable. It felt like he hit every single big shot in that game seven. Every time that Boston got close, it felt like it was Caleb Martin that was coming through in the clutch. Unlike another guy in the Miami Heat who was not good, Bam Adebayo was terrible in game six, and he was terrible in game seven.
Yeah, that's the one take I didn't like from Simmons' dad. oh, he had a everyone's going to think, if you look at the box score, he didn't have a good game, but he was just flying all over the place. And I was like,
yeah, I didn't see that. I did not see that at all. Now, you can make a case maybe defensively that he was good, but offensively he was terrible. I mean, again, he was a guy who kept losing the ball. Felt like there was a lot of times where I wasn't even confident he was going to catch the ball. And there were numerous times in those last two games where he had a little guy on him, like he got Smart on him, or he had somebody, he had Derek White on him, and he just didn't attack the rim and couldn't make anything. And it was not a good series for Bam Adebayo in any way, shape, or form, which makes it all the more remarkable that Miami was able to pull that thing off. I think the biggest thing that you take away from this is how good of a coach that Eric Spoelstra is, both from an X's and O's standpoint and also from a just motivational / keeping your team together, because that doesn't happen. I know that ultimately, and we say it all the time, I still think that so much of what happens comes down to the players on the floor, but the coach in this case, in order to keep those guys together, like the coach has to really be a guy that just oozes belief and just makes the guys believe that, look, when we lose that game six in such heartbreaking fashion, like I love what Spoelstra said on the podium immediately following game six. He's like, we want to play game seven. We wish we could play game seven right now.
It's an opportunity, right? Wasn't that what something like that?
Yeah. I mean, I just love, like, we want to play it right now. Like, if we could go back out on the court right now and play game seven, 15 minutes after game six ends, that's what we'd want to do. And those are things that, look, you can say, well, does it matter? Does it not matter? Does it matter halfway through the second quarter what Eric Spoelstra said after game six? I don't know if it does or it doesn't, but I do know that guys like Spoelstra that have the pulse of their team, they get guys to believe. And when you get guys to believe, it makes it a lot easier for them to buy into what you want to do X's and O's, or for what you're trying to get them to execute out on the floor. When they believe in you as a leader, it makes all the other stuff kind of click into place. And that's really what the art of coaching is all about. And I think Spoelstra was tremendous in that. And then you just look at all these things that went right for the Heat in terms of how well that Caleb Martin played and the contributions you got from Duncan Robinson, who basically through the regular season wasn't even playing at all. And then Strus and Gabe Vincent were both just outstanding in that series all the way around. And look, Miami deserved to win that series. I think that when you look at the totality of the series, to me, Miami was the better team. Now, it obviously could have gone a different way in game seven, but I was not in any way, shape, or form surprised that it went the way that it did. I mean, I think Boston just has been so wildly inconsistent that there was no way you could feel good about, hey, Boston's going to close this out in game seven because they got Tatum and Brown and they're at home. Like, that has not been the winning formula for Boston. Yeah. It just hasn't. Not consistently, anyway.
Yep, I agree. All right, so should we turn our attention to the finals, Mike?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, Nuggets in five. I'm giving the Heat a win.
You may be giving them more credit than they may deserve at this point. I just don't know how. I guess I would probably, I don't know. I don't know if I want to call a sweep, but I'm not sure that Miami is better than the Lakers. And I definitely know that Miami's not better than Phoenix. So I guess you split the difference and say Nuggets in five. That seems like a reasonable prediction. But I just don't see how – I don't see how Miami in any way, shape, or form deals with Nikola Jokic. Bam just isn't big enough. And I think Jokic is going to have his way with him in the post. And then you think about taking it one step further. Go ahead.
Udonis Haslam?
Maybe. Hey, I wanted to dust Udonis Haslam off yesterday when Bam was just dropping the ball and missing layups. I'm like, we got to get somebody else in there. But it just Miami just doesn't have the capability of doing what the Lakers did, for example. Like, who on the Miami Heat roster, if Bam isn't the guy, the primary defender on Jokic, are you going to put Kevin Love in there on him? I'm guessing that's not going to go well. So if you want Bam to be the guy that's roving, you got to find an initial matchup for Jokic, and you're not going to play Udonis Haslam. You're not going to play Kevin Love on him. Are you going to play Haywood Highsmith, who's like a 6'8 wing? Are you going to give that guy minutes trying to guard Jokic? I just don't see – I don't see where Miami has any answers for Jokic. Listen, and maybe
I don't disagree with you, Mike.
Maybe this is a series where Jokic has to score, though, as opposed to playmate, because I think – well, although at the same time, maybe Miami's just got to send double teams at him in order to control him. I don't know. I think Miami could go either way, right? You could just say, hey, let's make Jokic, who wants to pass – let's make him score 40 every game in order to beat us. Or maybe they say we can't allow Jokic to just destroy us at the rim. Maybe we do have to try to get the ball out of his hands and hope that Porter and KCP and Murray miss threes. I think those are your only two. I mean, those are your only two options, are to say, hey, we're going to just play them one-on-one and, you know, stay home with shooters and hope that Jokic doesn't want to shoot as much as we're kind of forcing him to, or we double team him and just hope that those other guys miss. Cause otherwise I just don't see the path. Now you can play a zone, but look, I'm
the Heat
guessing
are gonna con a zone, Mike.
Yeah. But I think Jokic is going to destroy that zone. Jokic is going to find the holes and he's going to pick out open shooters and he's just going to get them good shots. I don't think the zone is going to work nearly as well against Denver as it did against the Celtics. I just don't.
Probably not.
Like, if you put Jokic in that Al Horford spot at the high post, I mean, he's just going to destroy that, either just by rolling down the lane for his little floaters or by catching the ball there, putting it on the floor once or twice, drawing a double team, and then just kicking it to wherever the opening is. And I don't know, maybe that works for a half. Maybe it works for a couple of possessions, but Jokic is going to figure that thing out eventually, and he's just going to start shredding it with passing or by just taking the ball to the rim from that spot. Yeah. If, again, now maybe Miami can make some tweaks in terms of where they, what areas they leave open and how they rotate and where they go and how they close out to shooters, and depending on how Denver deploys Jokic. Obviously, there's a cat and mouse game and that whole thing, but I don't see the zone with as good a shooting as Denver has and the passing that they have with Jokic as sort of the fulcrum of attacking that zone. I don't see the zone being nearly as effective against Denver as it was against Boston. I just think that Denver has too many weapons and Jokic has the passing ability to be able to exploit those weapons no matter where Miami leaves an opening. Jokic is going to find that opening, and then from that opening, he's going to find open shooters. So I think it's going to be a struggle for Miami. No matter whether it's playing man zone.
Are you leaning sweep, or are you thinking five games?
I mean, I honestly have a hard time seeing how Miami gets a game, and yet at the same time,
you know, who would have thought Miami would have gotten here, right?
Yeah, like, nobody. I mean, we've continually underestimated what Miami is, and I think rightfully so. They've had some huge outlier. I mean, Caleb Martin's performance, especially in this series, has been just an unbelievable.
By Charlotte,
Yeah, I mean, it's an unbelievable outlier. I mean, it is an unbelievable outlier. Like, it got to the point where in game seven, every time he shot it, I was stunned if it didn't go in. And this isn't from a guy who's a star, an all-star. He wasn't even starting for the entire season. Last year,
he had four games of 20 points or more or something like that coming into this in the regular season.
I read that last year he was on the Heat roster last year, and in game seven last year against the Celtics, he didn't even play. So there you go. I mean, so that's a completely outlier performance. Now, again, who's to say they can't continue? I mean, guys played well for this entire series. Certainly he's capable of playing really well in the next series. I just think Denver has a lot of answers. I think that when you look at the matchups going the other way, when Miami has the ball, to me, I don't think Bam is a guy that really can hurt Jokic tremendously, right? Because he's not a great post-up player. He doesn't shoot threes. Now, he's a good passer, but okay. So I think Jokic is going to be okay defensively in this series. And then I think you look at the Aaron Gordon, Jimmy Butler matchup. Gordon's a guy who physically matches up really well with Butler in terms of size, strength, athleticism. I think that Aaron Gordon's going to be able to make it as difficult as you can make it on Jimmy Butler. And look, Butler's still going to, I'm guessing, have a great series, and he's going to be the Heat's best player. But Aaron Gordon is going to make it's not going to make it easy for Jimmy Butler to do what he wants to do.
Yeah.
And KCP's a good defender. Like I said, I don't think Jokic, who is not a great defender, but I don't think he's going to have to be in this series. I don't think Bam is the type of player that's going to really hurt him. And Michael Porter Jr., although he's not a good defensive player, he is 6'10", and he's gotten better from where he was in years past. I think Miami's going to have Miami was, 27th in the league in scoring in the regular season for a reason with the same personnel.
Yeah.
I think this series from Miami's offense is going to look more like what their offense looked like against the Knicks. And I think that Denver is going to be able to score against this team relatively easily. So I guess, something tells me that Miami's probably going to get a game, but just to be different from you, I'm going to say I'll go with the Denver sweep just because I just don't see the pathway where Miami generates easy offense. And I think there's a chance that some of their guys come down to earth a little bit. And I think Denver offensively, Miami's just not going to have answers for what Denver can throw at them, because I don't know if there's a good – look, nobody's had a good matchup on Jokic. I mean, the guy's averaging a triple-double in this playoff run. So I think the Nuggets – I'll go ahead and call it Nuggets sweep.
All right. All right. We want to talk briefly about the coaching hires, Mike.
Yeah, let's spend like 30 seconds on each one.
Nick Nurse, the Philadelphia 76ers.
I mean, he has no idea what he's stepping into, right? You don't know if Harden's going to be back. You don't know where we are with how Embiid feels about this team. You have to assume that Nick Nurse had conversations with both Harden and Embiid at some point prior to taking this job. If all those parts are back, I mean, Nick Nurse is a good guy to put in place to be able to make adjustments, and I think he's a good in-game coach. But I've been saying it for as long as James Harden and Joel Embiid have been in the NBA. No thanks as far as those two guys being the two guys that are leading my franchise if I want to win an NBA title. I don't think either one of them can be the best player on a championship team. And I'm dubious that either one of them honestly can be the second best player on a championship team, because I just don't think Embiid, he's just not in good enough shape. He's never going to be able to play 44 minutes in a playoff game and give you what you need in the fourth quarter. He's just not. And James Harden, I mean, anybody who's still arguing that this guy is an important playoff performer, the evidence is overwhelming. Look, I know he had two great games against the Celtics, but he also had four games where he was horrendous. And that's just the way it is. And he's never going to be a guy that you can count on. Maybe if he's your fourth best guy, maybe. Even then, I'm out. So I'm out. So Nick Nurse, does it make a difference? He's a good coach, probably a better tactician than Doc Rivers, but I don't think ultimately it matters, because the two stars on that team are flawed. Maybe the team looks totally different and Nick Nurse is coaching something different than what we think he's going to, but good hire for Philly, but I don't think it matters.
Okay. The Bucks hiring Adrian Griffin.
Surprising in that he's a rookie coach, right? For a team that is trying to win a title, right? It's just like the Celtics and Missoula, right? Where you hire a rookie coach. Now, obviously, the Celtics situation was a little bit different because of the Udoka and going out right before the season and having to hire somebody. And I'm always a proponent of, instead of hiring a retread, let's hire somebody who could potentially be a really good coach. But it's not something that NBA teams typically do. So, look, I don't know that much about Adrian Griffin as a coach. He played in the league. He's been an assistant at multiple places.
When he played in the league, did he play? I'm testing my knowledge, because he would have been when I was younger. So,
okay.
Did he play for Atlanta? What team did he play for? What team did he spend majority of his career with?
I feel like he was a journeyman. I feel like he was with a bunch of different teams. I read it this morning. I feel like he was with Dallas.
He was with Dallas during the Nash years, right?
Yeah, he was a lefty, kind of a bulky guy, like an undersized
Boston,
forward.
Boston, Dallas. Oh man, he was a journeyman. He played for Boston for 2 years, then Dallas for 2 years, then Houston for a year, Chicago for a year, Dallas again for a year, Chicago for a year. And then his last year, he split time between Chicago and Seattle.
All right, so there you go. So, look, I don't know much about the guy as a coach. I generally like hiring guys who are new that potentially could end up being really good coaches, as opposed to hiring a guy who's an average retread that's had multiple jobs.
Oh, yeah.
It is interesting, though.
His nickname was Classic Sports.
All right. I don't know what that means, but some of those nicknames,
and
man.
And the Hawk.
Okay. I'm not sure some of those nicknames are accurate. I'm not sure where some of those come from, but anyway.
It's a basketball reference.
I know, but I think those things are – I don't know. I think somebody's job is to make up fake nicknames for these guys that don't have one.
Old school.
There you go. I don't know enough about the hire to know whether it's a good hire or a bad hire. It's interesting in that they didn't hire an experienced coach for a team that obviously is trying to contend for titles. So that's where I'll leave it there.
I'm trying to see why his nickname was Classic Sports.
I don't think you're going to find anything. I think it was made up. It's because some kid, some intern at Basketball Reference decided that was going to be his nickname. That's what I predict.
Listen,
that's what I'm calling.
I was kind of hopeful that I would Google it and there would be some story.
No, there's nothing, man. Come on. It's time to leave that go.
All right. We'll see. I'll try to dig it up. I'll come back to it on the podcast next week.
There we go.
All right. So, are we missing anyone else?
Phoenix still hasn't hired someone.
Well, Simmons has it on good authority that what's his name is going to get hired, right?
Kevin Young.
Yeah, some guy.
I don't know who that guy is.
Kevin Durant's brother's sister's husband.
Something. I don't know. So if they hire him, that's fantastic. And then why are we? It feels like we're missing. Feels like we're missing an opening somewhere. Or am I not?
Well, there's still the Toronto job.
Detroit, right? Did Detroit hire somebody?
And Toronto hasn't hired anyone, right?
I don't think so. So you have Detroit and Toronto still open, I believe. Maybe I'm wrong.
Let's look. Pistons. Coach.
I feel like Detroit was still debating back and forth.
Yeah, they haven't hired anyone.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
One of three teams. The Pistons have a coaching vacancy. Hold on. Detroit News said there's three coaching vacancies and NBA coaching vacancies right now. Oh, there's a website for this. Coaching tracker. Oh, Rocket signed Udoka. I don't know if we ever talked about that. You want to talk about that really quickly?
Far as the quality of a coach, I mean, I think he proved himself to be a pretty good coach in his 1 year in Boston. So it seems like if you think about what the criticisms have been of the Houston Rockets, that they're undisciplined, that they're unorganized, that it's kind of a clown show. Well, based on what we saw out of Udoka in that first year in Boston, he's not going to put up with any of that stuff. And I know Houston has.
So you're saying that Harden isn't going to go back to Houston now?
I mean, he could. I mean, he still could. They have a lot of cap space. They could clearly sign him. But I think Udoka is a good hire if you get past whatever the issues were that he had in Boston without us really knowing that whole situation.
Yeah.
We don't know if he was just stupid or he was predatory in some way. and without really knowing the details of what went on.
Well, I feel like if he was predatory, I feel like he would be blackballed, right? Like,
yeah, it's probably true. And there'd probably be some law enforcement involved in some way. So I'm guessing he was just stupid, but he definitely proved that he could coach in that 1 year. So I think that's probably just from a purely coaching standpoint, if you eliminate the public relations and the perception, I think just as a basketball coach, it's probably a good hire for Houston and for those young guys to
It's Toronto, Phoenix, and
Detroit.
Detroit are the ones. Detroit. Here are the listed candidates on this website. For the Detroit Pistons, Charles Lee, Bucks assistant, Chris Quinn, Heat assistant, Bulls assistant Josh Longstaff, never heard of that guy. Nets assistant Brian Keefe, never heard of him. Vanderbilt head Ben's basketball coach Jerry Stackhouse.
Stackhouse, I could see that.
Kevin Ollie.
That'd be an interesting hire. Stackhouse as a head NBA coach would be interesting.
Kevin Ollie, which I feel like that one had traction, that it sounded like Kevin Ollie was going to maybe get that job. Some Pistons assistants, and that was it. For the Suns, it was Phoenix Suns head coaching gigs. Kevin Young, Mike Budenholzer, and Clippers coach Ty Lue. What?
Ty Lue, he's only got one more late year left on his deal.
And then Toronto is Kenny Atkinson, Charles Lee, Kevin Young, Jordy Fernandez, Darko Rajokovic, Chris Quinn, and Becky Hammon.
Interesting. I don't see her getting an NBA job. I just don't. Not that she's not deserving, not that she wouldn't do a good job.
Oh, and J.J. Redick.
You can't hire J.J. I'd hire if I was Toronto. Actually, if I was – probably not if I was Phoenix, but if I was Detroit or I was Toronto, I think I'd hire Kenny Atkinson. That'd be the guy I'd target.
Yeah, if you remember, he got young guys. The Charlotte job. He took the job and then left.
Yeah,
he's like, I'm not dealing with these Ball family. maybe he caught one of the Bridges thing. I don't know.
Maybe. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe a new Jordan's going to sell.
Wait. The other Toronto job, Steve Nash is also a candidate for the Toronto job.
Well, that would make sense, right? Canadian ties. I think Nash, I don't think we have any idea whether Nash is a good coach or a bad coach based on the guys that he was trying to deal with and figure out in Brooklyn. I mean,
I don't think there's no way
to really judge what Steve Nash is as a coach until he gets a second opportunity in a more stable, normal environment than what he had.
I don't know what you're talking about. That was a pretty stable environment there, Mike.
It was. It was
Kyrie,
very
stable. Kevin Durant, and James Harden.
Those are some real stable and
Ben Simmons and
stable personalities there that are, they're all about the team and giving it their all every single day. Or maybe not.
Maybe not.
Maybe not. Maybe not. Anything else?
I don't have anything else, Mike.
No, I don't either.
Mike, I have to say I don't share TikToks with you very much because I don't think you're on the TikTok.
I'm not on the TikTok.
I have a TikTok account that I use every once in a while for schools and related things. And I had kids write some dad jokes on the back of their math test.
Okay, so you got some good ones?
There was a good one, and this is the one I'm going to say, and I couldn't say it on the TikTok because it's like a bunch of students follow it, and there's not many students that will probably get this far in the podcast, so I feel comfortable saying this one. And they all have to be school-appropriate ones, Mike.
Okay.
So like, I keep it – like there were some good ones, but this one made me laugh, and it's very dark. So,
all right, I'm ready.
Why don't orphans play baseball?
I don't know why.
Because they don't know where home is. It's pretty brutal and dark.
That's a good one.
It's a good one. It made me laugh.
I don't think I've heard that one before. So that usually even ones that you laugh at that you're like, oh, I haven't heard that one in a long time, or I vaguely remember hearing that one. I don't think I've ever heard that one before. So that's a good one.
By the way, that came from like the quietest, nicest kid.
All right.
Like that you would ever expect it from. So
hey, all it takes is one. You just got to hear it somewhere and have a good enough memory to remember it. That's what matters. All right, sir, let's leave it there. We will. I think the plan is we're going to be back after
Thursday.
Each game of the NBA finals.
We're going to do our best, right, Mike?
We're going to do our best. I think last year we dropped the ball. We were trying to talk about this earlier that I think we just didn't do them because it was the Warriors and the Celtics. And to be honest with you, I just didn't want to talk about those two teams. So, but I think in previous years we did a pod after.
Mike's motivated because Jokic is in the finals.
Yeah, so. I'm motivated. I think this will be fun. So hopefully we're gonna bang out a 15 or 20 minute podcast after each one of the upcoming finals games. At least that's the plan. So we'll see how that goes. But nonetheless, we appreciate you sticking with us tonight. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies. And most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.